Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. Nine countries have taken part in the largest international aid airdrop in a single day into Gaza to mark the end of the Islamic fasting month of Ramadan. 14 aircraft delivered hundreds of tons of food and essential aid in a planned operation led by the Jordanian Air Force. The UK was among the participating nations. James Landell travelled on board one of the aircraft taking part in the airdrop.
This is the biggest aid drop yet. Nine nations, 14 aircraft, and it's been organised to mark the end of Ramadan. And that means that some of the aid that's been delivered today, it's not just food and water, it's also toys, it's also clothes. But the bottom line is it's not enough. It's a very expensive way of delivering aid. It's inadequate. It's a symbol of the failure to get aid in by other means. But as everybody on this aircraft will tell you, it's probably better than nothing.
The Electoral Court in South Africa has ruled that the former President Jacob Zuma is eligible to stand in the forthcoming election next month. Last week, the Electoral Commission excluded Mr. Zuma, who's campaigning for a new opposition party, Umkhonto weSizwe, because of a conviction for contempt of court. Jenny Hill reports.
This could have a significant impact on the outcome of next month's election. Jacob Zuma, the face of a newly formed opposition party, can now run as its leading candidate. Election officials had banned him from standing. They'd argued that the Constitution excludes people from public office if convicted and sentenced to more than 12 months in jail. Mr. Zuma was given 15 months in 2021 for failing to testify in a corruption investigation, though he served only three.
The European Court of Human Rights has issued a landmark ruling which climate campaigners hope will prompt governments across the continent to adopt a tougher approach on global warming. The court decided that Switzerland had violated the rights to health and life of a group of more than 2,000 elderly women by failing to properly fight climate change. The ruling cannot be appealed. France and Spain have said there will be additional security at UEFA Champions League football matches in Paris and Madrid on Tuesday and Wednesday. It follows threats posted on social media by an organisation aligned to the Islamic State group. Guy Hedgeco is in Madrid.
The authorities have confirmed that they are stepping up security because of these apparent threats that have been posted online by this group, which appears to be aligned to Islamic State. This group made reference to football stadiums of teams that are involved in the Champions League quarterfinals. Here in Spain, the authorities have said they acknowledge this threat and they are stepping up security. But they've also been keen to try and issue a message of calm.
BBC News. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Britain's Foreign Secretary David Cameron in Washington have been speaking about the need to reinforce support for Ukraine. At a press conference, Mr. Blinken said they had discussed ways to prevent the transfer of weapons to Russia, particularly from China and North Korea. Mr. Cameron said Ukraine needed air defences and ammunition, which he said Britain was working to supply. A court in southeastern Bangladesh has jailed 52 people arrested in a two-day operation against an ethnic armed group, the Kukichin National Front. The arrests were made in connection with bank robberies last week in the Chittagong Hill Tracts. The group says it's fighting for an autonomous state for the indigenous communities. The United Nations Migration Agency says the bodies of 38 Ethiopian migrants, some of them children, have been recovered after their ship capsized off the coast of Djibouti. The International Organization for Migration said it was assisting 22 survivors, but at least six others were missing. The boat was heading towards Yemen. Every year, thousands of Ethiopian migrants try to make the journey across the Gulf of Aden. A court in Australia has ruled that men can enter a women's-only exhibition in Tasmania. The exhibition lounge had sought to highlight historic misogyny by banning male visitors. And Roy Cheng has more.
The Ladies' Lounge exhibit at Tasmania's Museum of Old and New Art, or MONA, contains some of its most acclaimed works inside a space designed after an old Australian pub. It offers champagne and other luxury services, but only to women. One man who had been denied entry decided to sue. The lounge had asserted that rejecting men was part of the artwork, arguing Australian law allowed for discrimination designed to promote equal opportunity to those who had been historically disadvantaged. The judge said it was not clear how preventing men from experiencing the artworks held within the ladies' lounge promoted equality.
BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
Afternoon, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow, and this is A Public Affair. Today, we are continuing our conversation about reproductive rights. Joining us in the studio are two folks from UW-Madison's Collaborative for Reproductive Equality, or CORE. CORE is an initiative at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Their research is used to inform policy and programs so that all Wisconsinites may live with reproductive autonomy. Zakiya Soren is a registered nurse, RN, a graduate of the University of Madison, Wisconsin School of Nursing. She serves as outreach manager and engagement hub director for CORE. She directs the strategic planning and vision for outreach and engagement, builds community stakeholder networks and organizations and individuals to support their reproductive health goals. Her approach emphasizes reproductive and knowledge justice principles as guiding framework for collaborative liberation. Zakiya, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me here today, Ali.
Thank you for joining us on the show. And we also have on the air today, Umfan Ambong. Oh, I'm so sorry about the pronunciation of your name. I'm going to ask you to correct me many times today. Ufot is a research program coordinator for CORE. Her primary role is to coordinate CORE's research activities, administratively support the center, and manage CORE's undergraduate internship program. She assists with researching, compiling writing, editing CORE's briefs and products. Umfan's work is driven by her commitment to bodily autonomy and deep-rooted belief that reproductive rights are human rights. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
I want to jump into this conversation about what it looks like to research in the interests of reproductive autonomy and to do that from a framework that, you know, reproductive rights are human rights. And I want to start with you because that was part of your bio, Umfan. What does this work really look like kind of day to day? I think a lot of people would imagine that you all are, you know, studying abortion. And what does that mean?
Yeah, and I think it might be maybe helpful to get a little bit of share a bit of background in kind of how I came to do this work and where I came from. And so Ali mentioned, I am CORE's research program coordinator. So a lot of my job is really focused on supporting CORE's research endeavors, administrative, whether that's administrative or working in several research projects. And so my day-to-day really looks differently based on what we're doing currently. One of the tasks that I do is regarding to our post-war research study. And so that might look like interviewing participants to hear about their own pregnancy decision making experience. That could look like working on a CORE research brief, whether that's diving deep into research to read the data, looking at that and compiling it into a digestible and usable resource for distribution. It could also look like diving more into the administrative task, right? Of being in the university, of making sure that our center works and flows well. And so it really depends on which day and what that looks like. It could also look like being in meetings with some of our community partners, whether that's hearing about what are some of their research needs and thinking about where CORE can show up for organizations and specifically where my role can show up in that.
That seems like a tremendous body of work. And it, I would imagine, because you all allow for your work to be influenced by the needs of your partners, the needs of the community, that sometimes you all are uncovering information that really reveals kind of the misunderstandings that people have around reproductive care. Mm-hmm. Zakiya, can you talk a little bit about things you all have researched that have surprised you or have demystified some of the way people think, particularly about abortion?
Yeah, some of our research, I think, that we're doing right now is in some ways focused on, right, especially the post-obs world, right? And so we're really trying to understand how us living in Wisconsin in a post-obs world has impacted people's ability to exercise their bodily autonomy. One of the projects that I'm leading up right now is a power mapping project where we are working with Ubuntu Research and Evaluation to really look at what's happening in Wisconsin post-obs on the ground with community organizations, but also direct care organizations, folks that are also in hospitals, people that are in professional organizations, to really understand the landscape of what's happening in Wisconsin. What are the new networks that have come aboard, or not come aboard, but what are the networks that we don't know about what's happening in Wisconsin? And so some of the things that we are finding is that there is really an actual robust network that's happening outside of the things that you would think about. So within Wisconsin, what we have found is that we don't have any organization, something like NARAL, if you will, where you have this centralized bank of information and communication that's coming out. And really what we're seeing is how organizations and community members are really coming together to bridge those gaps within communities. And we're really seeing how folks are stepping into different roles that they haven't been in. So people who may have roles as like doulas, if you will, are now stepping into larger roles, almost like social workers, to try and really understand, like, where are the resources for folks in Wisconsin? Where are the where's the money going to come from? How do we work with other organizations to get people to have access to the care that they need, the reproductive health care that they need, and also as educators? And so what we're finding is that there is that piece where there's a gap in the education, if you will, and not so much the idea that, well, you're just not smart enough, but it's because things are changing so much and so fast that it is hard for folks to keep up with that information. And we're starting to uncover gaps there where people are like, we need this information. How do we get it? Who has it? And what would it, or what could it look like?
Zakiya, I think the point you're making is such an interesting thing to think mm-hmm. about from a research standpoint, especially in a space where abortion, you know, we had no access to abortion mm-hmm. in the state of Wisconsin for over 400 days.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, it would be, I guess, hard not to imagine that people who are supporting folks getting abortions wouldn't be a little bit nervous about right. sharing that they are doing that work.
Absolutely.
Do you all take precautions to ensure that you are not gathering information that could be incriminating, that could be used against people who are helping to support people who need to gain access to abortion care?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I'm going to defer to Emphan on this because I think she is working on some research projects right now that can really speak to how they protect participants' information and stories as we're moving forward in our research.
Thanks, Z. Yeah, and I think one of the things to think about with this question is really reminding in terms of like CORE's role mm-hmm. and our lane and it being specifically research. And so everything that we produce is evidence-based, right? It's really informed by our rigorous interdisciplinary research. Everything we put out, and so that's part of our approach to the truth and in highlighting it through a research frame and thinking about like with our postal research study being and having that be so important in order for us to be able to do this work, right? And be in folks being comfortable enough to share their stories is making sure that we are putting, we are adhering to those research standards. And we actually have been talking about this a lot with our power mapping, mm-hmm. right? It's like, mm-hmm. how do we think about privacy while also very much about like distributing the research and the information that's there, and wanting to do that in a way that also still
doesn't
create harm.
Exactly. And so that's also one of the things that what MFON was saying is that even in power mapping, when we're thinking about like, okay, what folks are telling us is X, Y, and Z. Here's what they do, how they do it. Depending on, you know, where they are in the community or even in organizations. And if we put together like all of this information, even if we take people's names out of it, if we take people's organizations out of it, and we say, here's what's happening. If we put together something that is basically saying, here's where you can find all of this information and where not only where the resources are, if we put something together like that and we put it out there, is that going to harm anybody, right? Like, is that going to harm the folks that are doing the work? Is that going to create an attack on anybody, any organization or individual that's doing that work? And so we take that very seriously. We're still having conversations about how to put that work out there. And that looks like going back to the folks that we've interviewed and saying, here's what we have. And what are ways in which you think we can also do this to make sure that we're mitigating any harm that might come?
I so deeply appreciate that consideration and the thoughtfulness that must go into this work, and also the risk that you all are taking yourselves in a climate like this, especially given some of the dynamics between our university and our legislature at this point. It's got to be kind of like navigating a minefield in terms of your ability to do this research well and to be able to prioritize the health and safety of people and the accuracy of your information while trying to navigate this political arena. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. And today we are talking to two amazing folks from CORE about the research around bodily autonomy and abortion in Wisconsin. If you want to join this conversation, the number is 608-467-5627. It was really hard for me to say that number because it's not the number I usually say. Huge shout out to John and Jade. We would not, you know, like, it just doesn't happen without John and Jade. Like, they're awesome. They're the reason that we are on the air and that we are having this like beautiful, focused and intentional conversation that fits so well into a series of conversations we've already had about reproductive rights. And so I think that's one of the things I really love about WORT is that you can be really thorough and intentional in terms of talking about what's going on locally. I want to talk about how you all do your work and prioritize, you know, the accuracy of your research in a political climate like Wisconsin around the areas of reproductive rights. And we'll start with you, Zakiya, and move over to MFON.
No, I appreciate that question. It's a really good question, Ali. And I think what it comes back to a lot of the time is, you know, our mandate, we are a privately funded program or research initiative within the university. So our funding comes privately. And, you know, one of the things is that we're not tax funder. We're not funded by taxpayers in Wisconsin. And so that's one of the things to kind of like bear in mind there. But the other piece of it, when we think about our research and how we do it, is that our research that we do the research to advance evidence, right? So that folks can exercise autonomy. And that means that it's going to be rigorous. It's going to be high quality. And nothing is going to change how we do our research. Nothing is going to change the nothing is going to change how we, our priorities in that, in the way in which we do it. Our main goal and focus is always going to be on bodily autonomy. And so no matter what the political climate is. It doesn't impact how we do our research. The only thing that I think we would really take into consideration when we're thinking about our research is basically the same way in which other state or local or county employees have to take into consideration, which is the fact that we can't advocate for laws or policies or candidates, right? So we can't do that. And so while we don't advocate for things, what we will do is we will put out evidence-based information for people to make decisions. And so we're not going to say, we'll say research shows, and here's what our research shows. Here's what evidence shows. And what people do with that then, like how they vote, what they vote for, what they advocate for based on the information and the data that we get from our research, that's the piece that we don't tell people what to do with. Right, that would be infringing on somebody's ability and their autonomy to make decisions for themselves. So no, the legislative piece or the politics of it does not impact the way in which we do our work.
And I would like to just reinforce what Z said about how our lane is very much research and how we conduct that research and that rigorous components about it. And I will add that although our work and how we do our work isn't adjusted by legislative or what laws prop out, right? We do respond to research needs that come from the legal landscape, especially in Wisconsin. What we found, especially with the Dobbs decision, was just a lot of confusion, right, about what can and can't be done, of like what's legal, what's not. One of the things that we had created is a Wisconsin state laws impacting abortion access brief that highlights the abortion restrictions and laws in Wisconsin, and creating it in a way where it was very much digestible, where anyone can access this information and using it and get a better understanding of what abortion access looks like in Wisconsin. And especially now with Wisconsin now starting up abortion care again, it's been really important for us to keep that information updated, to reinforce it, to distribute.
Oh no, I think absolutely. Like the fact that two abortion clinics opened in September, that we saw the clinic in Sheboygan open, you know, right as this year began, and that now a fourth clinic is open in Milwaukee. I think there's still so many people in Wisconsin who don't really feel like they have that information. Like they don't, either they don't feel like they know those clinics are open, or they're not sure what all that means for abortion access in this state after Dobbs created this period in time in Wisconsin for over 400 days where no abortion was performed and, you know, or no abortion clinic was open, I should say that.
Right.
And, you know, people really had to take into consideration leaving the state if they needed abortion care. Yeah. And so do you all feel at any point like you're doing the same work over and over again? You're like, does it feel a little bit like kind of a tennis match where, you know, it's like, now we do, now we don't, now we will, now we won't, we'll see what happens in June, what, you know? I mean, how intense is it to try to research something thoroughly as the conditions of that research really do change, as the legality around that research changes, as people's understandings change? And I imagine people need you now more than ever and want more from you than they have before. And how do you all manage that? And Zakiya, I'm going to ask you first.
thank you. That's a really great question, Ali. It is, you know, when we when we started our research, Dobbs hadn't happened yet, right? Yeah, Dobbs hadn't happened yet when we started our last cohort, if you will, of research projects that we're working on right now. So there have actually been some research projects that we're doing that are in process right now that have had to adapt and change to, right, the changing climate, where the ruling that happened last year where all of a sudden, like, it's pre-Dobbs, but now the 1849 law is no longer in effect. So now Planned Parenthood is starting to do abortions again. And so how, like, what does that mean for researchers? And researchers have had to kind of pivot what they're doing depending on what their original research was actually on. And you're right, there are a lot of people that need us more now. And I think I'm even beginning to see that a lot through the work that we're doing in power mapping, where we're starting to see, like, oh, here's more gaps, here's more gaps, here's more gaps. And it is really this balancing act. And one of the things that we've actually done at CORE to start addressing some of these gaps, especially in knowledge, are the webinars that we've started this year to talk about Dobbs. And you were actually, Ali, an amazing guest on our last webinar. We so appreciated, like, the way in which you did it was awesome. Like, just the storytelling piece of it. I love that.
I greatly appreciate that. And I think, like, I think it's a real testament to the strength of you all and the agility of your research that you're able to arrive at this moment and be present and kind of deal with the ever-changing reality of this work. And I've got to imagine that every once in a while you're like, you know, if I was researching open heart surgery, if I was researching brain cancer, if I was researching any other kind of medical reality, I wouldn't have to constantly be worried about the legal implications of my research or what the patients I work with have to be afraid of or the stigma that they're trying to navigate. If you were researching diabetes, you know, you might have to really think about the cost of people's prescriptions, but you wouldn't have to worry about the debate of whether or not those people should receive treatment, have access to treatment, have the right to address the needs of their bodies. How does that impact, Mpun, your ability to, you know, stay focused within the research and create research that is in service of, you know, folks seeking abortion access?
I think one of the things we pride ourselves with, especially with the constantly changing, is always going back to our briefs and updating it, right? Especially when we think about with the landscape changing and making sure that the information that is up is relevant, is updated and is a usable format, right? And when you ask about that pivot in terms of with the change, with in addition to our power mapping research study, we've also seen that in our post-war research study, in which our initiative was to capture people's pregnancy experience to seeking abortion care during when the 1849 law was in effect. And with abortion care now starting up in Wisconsin, we've kind of had to not quite adjust the way, but like add in to capture those experiences, right? And adding to that gasp in knowledge. And you asked me a second part. Could you repeat that, please?
You know, I think I was asking about kind of how you maintain your focus in this current moment, which I do feel like you've explained really well. And it made me start to think about really like what this looks like for people who are, you know, who are glad that abortion was banned and that we went back to eight. I mean, I think the whole point of that ban, right, was to make sure people had fewer abortions. And so you all are doing the research. Did you all find that because Roe v. Wade was overturned, that people stopped having abortions, that there were fewer abortions in the state of Wisconsin? What was that impact? Did your research look into that?
We did. One of the things that we analyzed was really the cost of out-of-state abortion care for Wisconsinites, right? Because we recognize that just because abortion is banned in the state doesn't mean that people stop having or getting abortion care. It just means that folks end up having to travel more, right? And so we look at about the cost of it, right? The financial, the emotional cost of needing to travel out of state. And one of the things that we found that the cost of an out-of-state abortion kit in Wisconsin is over $1,000, right? And when you think about that in the context that 40% of adults could not cover an unexpected $400 expense, right? We know that a ban like this really directly impacts low-income people, Black and Brown people, and the need to the travel distances, right? And also the emotional cost of not being able to access desired abortion care. Mm-hmm. And how does that impact people's health and well-being? How who desire abortion care but can't access it, especially when they can't access it due to financial constraints.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate you both naming that the impact wasn't just in whether or not people had abortions, but really the kind of position we put people who needed abortions in and the expense to those people, and the relationship it has to people's dignity, people's privacy, people's ability to take care of their families. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow, and we are talking with CORE. This is a public affair. If you want to join this conversation, if you have important research questions about abortion and reproductive rights, we want you to give us a call at 608-467-5627. That was the easier to do the second time I did it, but still completely unnatural in terms of having a different phone number today. So, you know, just for the folks who call regularly, we are using another number. It is 608-467-5627. Let's like give a call, ask some questions about abortion, make sure that I got the number right on the air. Like help us out. Be a team player today on WORT while we're talking about abortion with CORE. And we're talking about the really important work and the really important research that you all are doing and how you're getting that information out to people. I would imagine that, especially listening to you talk, Mfun, about like the need to make sure this information is up to date, that creates a lot of pressure, right? Is like, this is changing. We want to make sure people have good information. We want to make sure that, you know, people aren't being confused by the ever-changing political climate. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a lot of confusion about what abortion is, when abortion is medically necessary, why people have abortions. Do you all feel like in your work you're able to clear some of that up, to really kind of give people the tools to understand the necessity of abortion, and to have more empathy and compassion towards people who find themselves needing access to abortion care?
Yeah, I think we've actually covered that in a few of our CORE briefs, right? Like, who has abortions and what does that look like? And I think, you know, it's when you talk about like data and you talk about and you're putting it out and you're trying to make sure that the way in which you put it out is like, you know, like here's this evidence based, it's like policy relevant information. I also think that there is an opportunity there to try and make things a little bit more not so much translatable, but almost like a story or almost more relatable, right? I think there's an opportunity there that we are still working with to make sure that our information that we put out is done in a way that is relatable to community. Because it's one thing for our work that the data, the information to be like, hey, here's like a brief, here's a study, here's information to put out for folks that are normally involved in this work. But there's a whole nother piece of making sure that it is relatable to folks in the community. And I think one of the things that we're actually doing that's really cool is working with a program within the university called CARDS, and they're the Community Advisory Research Design and Systems. I forget the S. I always forget the S. But Mfun's going to find it for me.
I appreciate that you just like started typing immediately. You were like,
she knew I was going to forget the S again. We are going to solve,
like, I love that you are Zakiya's Jade, you know.
Yes. Strategies.
Yes.
And so they're this amazing program where you work with them either with your research or work that you want to put out, and they have community members that you work with, and you bring your information to them and they go over it, and they do it in a way where you are just sit, like, you answer the questions, they'll look through it, it is facilitated. All you do, you show up and you answer questions and you try and help them understand what you're trying to do. And, you know, as an example, we put out a core infographic and we thought it was like just the best, and it was on it was on crisis pregnancy centers, and we're like, we got this. And we go to CARDS, and, you know, like, the community members are like, we don't understand this.
Yeah.
What is this? Are you saying, like, this is a place that we should go to? Is this great? Like, is it good? You're like ping-ponging back and forth. You need to be more precise and specific. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, because we're coming from it from a standpoint of already, like, being involved in the information. So we don't have the lens of coming into it not knowing. And they're just like, this ain't it. And we're like,
no,
okay.
I mean, it's such an interesting situation, though, when you are put in the position of like, well, it's not, you know, I don't get to say good or bad.
Right.
Like, I probably have my own feelings about this, which is the thing I think is important to recognize, mm-hmm. that you all position yourselves objectively for the sake of research. You gather information, but you both have your own stories related to reproductive justice. You have your own opinions and your own space within mm-hmm. in this work. Talk a little bit about why this work is important to you, how you found yourself doing this work, Mfun. What is kind of the origin story of you as a researcher, and as a person who cares deeply about reproductive rights as human rights?
Yeah, thanks. I think for me, like, research kind of snuck up on me, but it's been great experience. But a little bit of background about me. So I'm Nigerian, right? Born in Nigeria, raised in Maryland, and grew up in this household that was very traditional, very patriarchal. And growing up, like, and granted, I love my family, I love our culture, but we are quite patriarchal and a little bit sexist. And growing up, I've
sprinkle
always,
of sexism. Yes,
I've always been told that you can't do this because you're a girl. Your brother can; he's a boy. Mm. And from a young age, that would just always light my fire, right? A quick way for my mom and I to get into an argument. And it wasn't until college, with my undergraduate study, gender women's studies, that I was really able to learn more and add definitions to those feelings, and really learning about bodily autonomy, learning about the reproductive justice framework, learning about reproductive rights. And especially being in courses around global women's health, global poverty, and really starting to see that a lot of restrictions that are placed on women and girls are tied to their reproductive health, their reproductive autonomy, and their ability to choose if to parent, when to parent, and how to parent. And having that combo of those two, and then also recognizing the importance of information, the power behind having knowledge and having information, and really seeing how we can merge that those two through research, and through research that is both rooted in evidence and also translated in a way where people are able to use it to make informed decisions. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that it coming together really just taps into a lot of my values in terms of bodily autonomy, reproductive rights, being able to do what you want with your body, how you want with your body. And my journey to CORE, I'm one of the COVID grads, you know, graduated spring 2020, beginning of the pandemic.
Okay, young person, we see you. Just over here showing off. We see you. We're glad that you are young, but yes. Welcome to the workforce. Tell us more.
Right, and one of my professors, who Professor Leslie Bartlett, we shout her out, really sharing this job posting with me and seeing that, oh wow, this is really an organization that's like focused on research, evidence based, and this deep rooted value of arming Wisconsinites with information so that they can make that that informed decision for themselves, and really having both and being in the space for three and a half years now. Of really learning, of growing, of hearing people's stories, of being in spaces, and it just continuing to add fuel to that fire that was lit.
So I feel like I love that you like both were able to talk about like your work, but also how your work connects to your childhood and the way that you were raised, and you know, kind of your initial experiences with sexism and gender-based discrimination really being a catalyst for why you positioned yourself in this work. I think that's so interesting in part because so many of the men who are legislating about reproductive health have no experience with pregnancy, are positioned with privilege in terms of gender dynamics. And it seems to be that that disconnect fuels so much of the misunderstanding around abortion care. Zakiya, I'm curious about for you, kind of, how do you balance the way that you think about this issue, the way you've been personally impacted by, you know, reproductive justice in the United States, and the need to create really objective, well-informed research without kind of taking the bait of playing politics?
That's such a good question, Ollie. That...
Awesome. How do you do it?
You know, it's something that I still grapple with, right? Recognizing, well, first, I think we need to recognize that, like, we're not, like, unbiased, right? And research isn't that. But we can recognize our biases, and we can do things to make sure or to check our biases while we're doing that research. But there's not going to be anything that's going to be unbiased or truly objective that comes out. Like, it's not exactly possible. People's beliefs and everything will in some way color or shape what they're doing. But then on top of that, right, like making sure those checks are in place and acknowledging that this is the case and this is where I'm coming from, but also making sure that we try to, that we do everything we can to not only recognize those biases, but understand how it may impact the research and then do things to mitigate that impact. But when it comes to reproductive justice and how I balance that with having to also be in a space where I have to be more careful, I guess I would say, about, you know, depending on where I am and who I'm talking to, how I have to come across. I tend on some of the sides not to, right? Like the work that we put out and the evidence that we put out, like, that's one thing. I will share that out. I will talk about it. I will say evidence shows all of these things. And in everything else I do, in the work and how I do it, is always framed by the principles and through the lens of reproductive justice. And it's always going to be that. So I am always going to center voices of Black women, Indigenous women, and other women of color. I'm always going to be the one to that's looking around and saying who's not here and who should be here, whose voices are not being heard.
Well, and it's interesting to hear you frame that as like, you know, to say like we all have bias and we're always going to have bias, because I'm like, I think if I was talking to an open heart surgeon and I was saying, you know, how do your beliefs impact the way you do this work?
Yeah.
I think that there's a different way that would be thought about.
Yes.
And, you know, we live in a community where the outcomes in the state of Wisconsin, the Black maternal mortality rate is three times that of white people, right? Like, bias is at play on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
Why are you more likely to acknowledge your bias, especially when you're the next thing you're talking about is centering the voices of people who have not been heard from? Is that a bias? Is it a bias to say, hey, we haven't heard from this group and now we're going to? Or is that an attempt really to reconcile the biases of other researchers who haven't been forced to talk about their beliefs?
You know, it's really interesting. I've been told in some ways that I've been told in when I talk about what I do and how I do it, especially when I put a lot of time and energy into community, because I think without community and the people that are most impacted by the policies and that we have in the state, I think that when I do go out there and put a lot of resources there, and I talk about how I do that, because that as an outreach manager is what I'm supposed to do, right? Mm-hmm. I've been told you're doing your job. Right, I'm doing my job, right? And I think I'm doing great. And I've also been told, well, you're privileging them. You privilege, right, community over like maybe a grasstops organization, or you privilege community, you know, over other direct care organizations. And to me, I'm like, no, right? Like, if we don't have the very people involved in the work that we do that are being impacted, how is it going to be sustainable? How is it going to be impactful to them in any meaningful way? How are we the ones that get to say we are the expert? Why are we the ones that get to produce this knowledge and say, but your communal knowledge, your experiential knowledge, that is not important to us. We can't move toward reproductive justice. There can be no liberation collectively unless we are looking at the folks and bringing everybody to that table, and then we're moving away, right? Like, folks that have privilege, folks that are benefiting from the system have to know when to take a step back and let other people there and listen. It doesn't mean, right, that, you know, the knowledge that you produce isn't important. It just means that there's other types of knowledge that belong in this conversation that need to be here for us to actually move forward with the work. And so it is hard, Ali. It's hard every day. And a really quick answer is, one, it's hard, and two, create my own community that's doing the work, because you're not always going to get it where you are, but you have to create that community around you for that support to create your own capacity to keep on going.
I think that what you said lends itself so easily and so well to the idea that knowledge is power. And if you're just joining us in part of this conversation, and you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, I'm Ali Muldrow, and we're talking about reproductive rights and research with two folks from CORE who are just like sharing with us really brilliant insights into this current moment and the work they're doing and how that work has evolved. And kind of playing off the idea that knowledge is power, I imagine that there are people who just wish you all weren't doing this research. People who benefit from misinformation around reproductive rights. People who benefit from being able to talk about women and people who need abortion access in a way that is not accurate to who those people are. What kind of pushback, Mvun, do you get for this work? What kind of, you know, are there people who say you shouldn't be doing this, or you shouldn't be doing it like this, or there is, you know, that you all are part of the problem?
I think by nature of abortion and doing abortion research, we do, right? Mm. We get it everywhere. And we navigate that, you know, as best as we can, while very much staying within our research lane and reinforcing that. And I think it just really comes down to the fact that abortion is a vital part of public health, right? It is something that is necessary and that improves folks who have desired abortion care's health and well-being. And so we are constantly having to navigate that and doing it in a way where we can continue to do our work and continue to create important research and important information. And at some point, right, this is our value, this is our goal, and we are going to keep doing our work the way we're doing our work, open to feedback, but we are going to be here.
Do you ever fear for kind of the safety of your team, for the ability of you all to do this work, to be publicly engaged in this work, and for people to be really upset by that and retaliate, or be cruel to you in a variety of ways. Have you all experienced that at CORE? Are there things you all do to protect yourselves from some of the hostility that this work inspires? You know, in part because of where we're at politically right now. Zakiya, mm-hmm. I'm curious about, you know, where that lands with you.
Yeah, that, so yes, we have had some folks that are affiliated with CORE that have had death threats and where they have needed to, you know, change numbers or move. And so that
change
has...
numbers or move, that's like not casual. I've had the same phone number since I was 19 years old. That would be like, that'd be such a big deal.
Yeah, no, it is a big deal.
Like relocating your home, right? Like that's the level of threat.
Deal.
So folks have done that.
Exactly. And, you know, and then what we also, you know, things that we've done, especially with our comms folks, is to look to see, like, we will sit down and we'll be like, how do we scrub, in a sense, like our names, addresses, phone numbers off of like databases or places where people can either pay to look up our names and addresses and phone numbers. So what do we need to do to be like more careful about having public information out there about ourselves? And so we do that at intervals to make sure that we are not, you know, still out there or you know, find new ways or new apps or whatever that might be out there for that. And so we do those things to make sure that we are also not the recipients, you know, of those things happening.
One of the data points I've heard many, many times since Roe v. Wade was overturned is that there are more Americans who support abortion access, even if they support abortion access up to a certain point or within specific situations. There are more people who support abortion access than people who do not. Do you all feel like you've been able to shed some light on that dynamic, on, you know, kind of the overrepresentation of voices who are opposed to abortion access? Or do you think that maybe we're missing some of how many people really are pretty interested in seeing abortion eliminated as an option?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't think...
I can hop in really quickly to talk about one of the things that we've kind of like to address this idea of folks' lack of support for abortion care. We actually have one of our research studies that really talks about clinicians' perspective when it comes to abortion care and their personal opinions about it, how that impacts how their referral to abortion care. And what we see is that that more physicians like support abortion care, yet think that their fellow colleagues don't. And so that's one of the information that's been really important for us to kind of to debunk this idea that most people that to debunk this, to reflect that there is really strong support for abortion care. Another thing that we really publish is trying to talk about like who has abortions in Wisconsin, in the U.S., in Wisconsin, and highlighting that 59% of people who have abortion are already parents, right? There's this narrative that they're like abortion is associated with promiscuity, and also with like young people, and it being this avenue to maybe be more promiscuous, right? But this idea of like, no, most people are parents. Majority of folks who seek abortion care are also more in their 20s, in middle income. And so wanted to really highlight that and really just talk about, again, this idea of like, of that it is a part of healthcare. It's safe and it's common. And with or without restrictions, abortion care, people will continue to seek abortion care.
Absolutely. I so deeply appreciate both of you for speaking to that. And I want to acknowledge that we had a caller on the line, Ben. And so behind you, Jade was trying to get my attention to acknowledge that Ben wanted to join the show to say forced labor is slavery. He specifically wanted to call out, young girls who are pregnant due to rape not being able to get abortions. I do think the adultification and hypersexualization of abortion is something that we need to talk to. And I hear you in what you just said, you know, that most of the people who have abortions are, you know, this age, have children already, are middle income folks. Like, we don't want to stereotype who needs an abortion. Mm-hmm. And yet there are these situations that are pretty tragic and can be really life threatening for young people in the state of Wisconsin. What is happening for our young people? You saw in Texas that teen pregnancy rose for the first time in a decade after Roe was overturned. For young people in Wisconsin who may have been assaulted, may have become pregnant for whatever reason, however, at early ages, what does this mean for the healthcare that they have access to? And have you all been researching the impact on adolescent folks and young folks?
M-Fun's like, I want this one too.
I think, this is such a big thing, right? Because when we think about all the restrictions that come with accessing abortion care, it's compounded when you're young, when you're a minor. The legal landscape of needing to go through judicial bypass for a young person, getting parental consent, needing to jump through that time-consuming, complicated, expensive cases, right? Where we're thinking about if a young person needs to go to court to get judicial bypass, how do they do that when they have school? So thinking about that experience of seeking abortion.
I've done that. Was part of how I had an abortion at 16, was by getting parental bypass. I think, you know, in taking into consideration what this means for young people, and really thank you for emphasizing restrictions, because I was talking to a man yesterday, on Sunday, I'm sorry, on Sunday, about, you know, the restrictions. And he was like, I don't know, I don't think having an ultrasound is that big a deal. And I was like, I think it is. I think if you're a 14-year-old who's been sexually assaulted, having a vaginal ultrasound in order to access an abortion is re-traumatizing.
Yes.
Zakiya, we are running out of time. And so the last thing I want to ask you both is, how can people support the work of CORE? How can people find your research? How can people keep up with what you're doing and use your work to inform their lives, their health, their activism?
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. I would say if they're looking for any of our work to go online, you can either type in UW CORE into your search, or you can go to, core.wisc.edu, and you can find our research projects that we have, current and past ones, to see what's been done. You can go on to publications and resources, and you'll be able to see the briefs that we've done as well. And you can see infographics. You can see us, who's working at CORE as well. And then you can also see if we're putting on any events. And we do have a webinar coming up this Friday from noon to 1, and that's going to be on contraception and access to contraception. And so that you'll be able to find all of our stuff there. I think one way, or just really quickly, if you want to get into learning more about the work, I would especially, well, for me, I'm going to say reproductive justice. And I'm going to say a good way to start that is to start with Reproductive Justice, An Introduction by Loretta Ross and Ricky Salinger. That to me is the best way to really start understanding what everyone is facing, not just here in the United States, but also abroad. And another great book would be Killing the Black Body by Dorothy Roberts. And
I cannot thank you all enough for joining us, for sharing your information, for sharing your research. Thank you for doing the work you're doing at CORE. One last thing before we're off the air.
And follow us on social media at WISC CORE, WISCCORE, on Instagram and Twitter to follow our work.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me here today,
thank
y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. I'll see y'all next week. Don't make donations where you can, I'll get your dough back. The apathetic bull, to send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold.
Democratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show, Congress is back in session this week, and the House will return to the issue of military aid spending for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The proposed aid, held up by some Republicans, has been stalled for months, and the looming fight ahead threatens to topple the speakership of Mike Johnson. We'll talk about all this with John Nichols of The Nation magazine. We'll also talk about President Joe Biden, the pressure he's receiving over Gaza, and this year's presidential and congressional elections. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. Nine countries have taken part in the largest international airdrop of aid into Gaza in a single day. The operation was timed to coincide with the end of the Islamic fasting month of Ramadan. 14 aircraft delivered hundreds of tons of food and essential aid. Hussein al-Shabli is one of the organisers behind the Jordanian part of the airdrop.
We are now in Ramadan and are nearing Eid, during which time there will be a focus on increasing the delivery of aid that's suitable for this time, an attempt by Jordan to spread some sort of joy to our people in Gaza, including children, by sending them new clothes for Eid, even sweets, and more food.
The head of the main UN agency in Gaza has warned that the amount of aid reaching Palestinians